Our first case of the morning is Appeal 073145, and it's the United States v. Calderon-Acevedo. And Mr. Camarena?
Good morning, Your Honors. Government counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Paul Camarena. I'm the Court-appointed counsel for the appellant in this case, Mr. Juan Carlos Calderon-Acevedo. Originally, when I filed this brief, I anticipated that I would argue to this honorable court that the district court had incorrectly applied the guidelines. By way of background, the guidelines section 2L1.2 pertains to defendants who have been deported from the United States and who have illegally reentered. The section makes a distinction between defendants who have previously been convicted of a crime of violence as opposed to defendants who have been convicted of an aggravated felony. The section states that if a defendant has previously been convicted of a crime of violence, that defendant is subject to a 16-level enhancement, the largest single enhancement found in the guidelines. The guidelines section also states that if the defendant had been convicted of only an aggravated felony, the defendant is only subject to an 8-point enhancement.
Now, in light of the district court's conclusion that it believed the defendant's sentence was appropriate in light of the Section 3553A factors, whether or not he committed a crime of violence does not make any difference to this defendant, does it?
Your Honor, I would concede that if the district court had sufficiently justified her reasons, I strike that, Your Honor. I strike that, Your Honor. May Your Honor please repeat the question?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that, or let's put it this way, whether or not he committed a crime of violence just doesn't, for him, for his sentencing, it's not going to make a difference, because what the judge did was she stated that she believed the sentence was justified independently under the Section 3553A factors, so that she had, you know, two reasons going.
I understand Your Honor's questions, and I understand the point that Your Honor would make. I do recognize that the district court in this case held that even if a crime of violence and 16-point enhancement was not appropriate in this case, and only the aggravated felony enhancement was appropriate, Her Honor would still impose the same sentence by way of variance. Essentially, what the district court indicated was that the district court would do by way of variance what it would have been prohibited from doing by way of application of the guidelines. And I would point out that in the case of Gall versus the United States, the Supreme Court did explain that should the district court decide that an outside guideline sentence is appropriate, this honorable court must consider the extent of the deviation and ensure that the justification is sufficiently compelling to support the degree of the variance. I would point out to Your Honor that the variance that the district court purported to apply in this case more than doubled the otherwise sentencing guideline range. It was more than a 91% increase over the high end of the aggravated felony guideline sentencing range. I would note to this honorable court that considering that aggravated felonies have been held to include malicious shootings into dwelling homes, discharging of a firearm into a vehicle, and Mr. Calderon's, the appellant's, exact same prior offense, we would submit that this honorable court should require the district court to sufficiently explain why this particular aggravated felony would warrant such a drastic increase.
Well, of course, Judge Conlon noted that Mr. Calderon Acevedo had an extremely dangerous nature, as was evidenced by the circumstances of his prior offense, which was endangering, you know, an infant and a toddler in their home, and that he began his criminal activities when he was very, very young as a Latin Kings gang member. He had no verifiable employment history. He had a long criminal record that included batteries, assaults. And she talked about protecting the public and teaching him respect for the law. So I just don't know how much more you would have needed here. But
Your Honor, I would point out that Mr. Calderon Acevedo's, the appellant's, criminal history was already calculated within the appropriate guideline range. So Her Honor, Judge Conlon should be required to submit more than his criminal history to essentially double the appropriate guideline range. Her Honor did point out that the offense endangered an infant in the house. I would note to this honorable court that another district court also analyzed this very exact same offense, and that factor also would have been present in that case. So the fact that offense would have endangered an infant in of itself should not be sufficient to essentially more than double the appropriate guideline range. I would also note that the government in its reply brief suggests the position that an incorrect application of the guidelines can be cured by way of variance. And in support of that position, the government cites this court's case of the United States versus Gordon. However, I would point out that in that case that the government cites, this court stated that it begins by ensuring that the district court did not commit any significant procedural error, such as improperly calculating the guideline range. And also note that the district court did note, and I would quote the district court here, it said it didn't think the answer was clear-cut on the issue of the enhancement, but nevertheless applied the higher 16-level enhancement. Given that the district court, we would submit, did apply an incorrect guideline calculation and also gave what we consider a cursory statement as to why it would more than double the guideline range, we would submit that a remand is still necessary to allow the district court to more fully explain itself, to allow for appropriate appellate review.
You're in your rebuttal. Do you want to save some time?
I will, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ms. Zimmer, warning.
Good morning. I'm Marnie Zimmer on behalf of the United States. As you just discussed, the court found that in this case, if an 8-level enhancement applied rather than a 16-level enhancement, the sentence would have been the same given the defendant's personal characteristics, including his criminal history, which involved many, many arrests, and as the district court outlined in her reasoning, the facts underlying those arrests and convictions involved crimes of violence. She also noted that the defendant had a senior role in the Latin King gang, that he had no verifiable employment, and that in one of his convictions, the facts underlying the conviction involved firing a shotgun into a building where a toddler and an infant slept. As to the 16-point enhancement that the district court applied as to the defendant, it did not err in finding that the defendant's prior conviction for discharging a shotgun into a building which the defendant knew was occupied constituted a crime of violence under Guideline Section 2L1.2. In reaching her conclusion, the district court properly looked at the statutory elements as well as what was charged in the indictment to which the defendant pled guilty.
And the defendant was charged with the knowing firing of the gun into the building.
That's
right?
Correct.
Not knowing that it was occupied. Knowing that the building was occupied.
The defendant was charged with knowing that the building was occupied.
And that was not in dispute.
No,
the charge was not in dispute.
That's correct. The knowing prong is what makes this a crime of violence and makes it fall within the definition of crime of violence under Guideline Section 2L1.2.
Now, the O'Farrell case in the Fifth Circuit, that takes a different take on this. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But in that case, the court noted that it was construing a Virginia statute, and under that statute, there was no requirement that the defendant know that the building was occupied. I believe they used the language that the building could happen to be occupied. And in addition, under the Virginia statute, it made it a crime for the defendant to shoot into an unoccupied building as well. So that case is distinguishable because, as the court noted in that case, the building didn't have to be occupied. If it happened to be occupied, the defendant could still be convicted under that statute, which is obviously very different here.
The Illinois statute does allow conviction if the person reasonably should have known.
That is correct. Well, the language of the statute is knows or should have known, but
in which way was this defendant charged?
This defendant was charged, and the exact language was with the knowledge that the building was occupied.
Is that of significance to you?
Yes, it is, because I believe that when a defendant fires into a building knowing that a person is in that building, that clearly shows the use of force or the threat of force against the person that is in that building.
Go ahead.
You know, let's be a devil. The elements of his offense itself relate solely to property. With any harm to a person flowing incidentally from having used physical force against a building. Given that, we wouldn't categorize this as a crime of violence, would we?
I don't think that the person being in the building is incidental to the crime he's being charged with when he knows, when he fires into the building, that a person is in that building. I think that's a very important distinction, and that the state could not have proved him guilty of this offense as they charged it without proving that when he fired the shotgun into the home, he knew there was a person present in that home. So I don't believe that in this case a person being present was incidental. And I also think that not only does it show a use of physical force against the person in the building, it also shows a threat of physical force when you know someone's in a home and you fire a shotgun into it.
Well, you know, we haven't really said that in the circuit yet, have we? Define exactly whether or not, to what extent it is a crime of violence or whether it's an aggravated felony. That's why this decision, if we rule on that issue, is going to be a first impression in this circuit?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that you recently ruled that this statute did constitute a crime of violence under a different guideline section, and that in that case, United States versus Rice, your reasoning is instructive. But I also believe that you don't need to reach that decision here because, as I stated earlier, the district court gave a very thorough explanation as to why she felt that the guideline calculation was appropriate and the 46-month sentence was appropriate for this defendant given the 3553A factor. So I don't believe that you need to reach that decision in this case.
It's really irrelevant in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, we can. That may well be, and maybe we don't need to make that decision here today. But it is a decision that's going to have to be made at some point. And that's why I just wonder if the government, I don't know whether it's confined to this district or circuit, or whether there's something national that the United States takes a position on this one way or the other.
You mean
because we have there's you distinguish the Faro case, but it's still it's just not clear cut. And I just wondered if there's I don't want to write anything extra in the law. That's all.
Well, I believe that other circuits have also addressed this issue and found that the important thing to look at here was whether or not the statute at issue required that the defendant know that the building was occupied, that there was a person in the building. And I think that common sense tells us that when a person is in a building and a defendant fires into that building.
Well, I don't think we can talk about common sense when we have, you know, for instance, the Fifth Circuit case law, which would, my view is that Alfaro would probably support a ruling that his offense didn't constitute a crime of violence. I don't know. You know, we have that Ninth Circuit case that noted that the reckless act need only be directed toward the dwelling or building, not at the life or safety of others, and so the offense was not necessarily a crime of violence. So when you start to talk about common sense, you're saying that the Fifth and the Ninth have none.
Well, forgive my poor choice of words, but I believe that actually in the Fifth Circuit, to take the position that this statute constitutes a crime of violence under this guideline section would not be inconsistent with that case, because the Fifth Circuit does note in that case that the Virginia statute, first of all, allows a defendant to be convicted under it by shooting into an unoccupied school building. That Virginia statute also allows a defendant to be convicted without the knowledge that a person was in the building, but that a person just might be in the building.
Well, Alfaro held that the offense didn't constitute a crime of violence because a defendant could violate the statute merely by shooting a gun at a building that happens to be occupied without actually shooting, attempting to shoot, or threatening to shoot another person. And so the offense didn't have an element, did not have as an element the use of force against another person. So I think we might be seeing that case a little differently here.
Does it matter what type of building? I understand this was a single-family dwelling. Is that correct?
That's correct,
Your Honor. This is a house as opposed to an apartment building or some other type of building. Would that make a difference?
Not under this statute. The statute doesn't specify a residence. It just says building. Mm-hmm. And if there's no further questions, I have nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zimmer. Mr. Camarena, you have 2 more minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I realize I don't have a lot of time, so I will be brief. The application note makes clear that what is relevant in the crime of violence analysis is not the underlying facts of the offense, but the actual elements of the offense. The appellant pled guilty to a charge of discharging a firearm at or into a building the defendant knows or should know is occupied. The elements of those offense, as defined by the Illinois Court of Appeals, are simply discharging of a firearm at a building when the defendant should know that the building is occupied.
What, wasn't he charged under the knowing branch, not the should have known branch of that Illinois statute?
Yes, Your Honor. Nevertheless, a defendant would still be able to violate this statute if a defendant were to fire a firearm at the first floor of the Sears Tower.
But what he pled guilty to was what he was charged with, and that was firing it into the dwelling knowing
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. He pled guilty to discharging a firearm at a building that he knew to be occupied. So the state in that case would have been able to convict a defendant had a defendant fired at the first floor of a building, of a multi-story building that the defendant knew to be completely unoccupied except for the top floor. In that case, the elements of discharging a firearm at a building that the defendant knows to be occupied would be satisfied. However, that would not be an offense that has an element of force against the person of another, as required by the application notes.
Does this have to be aimed at a person or targeted at a person specifically?
Your Honor, I'm glad that you asked that question, because Pursuant to this statute, it's irrelevant whether the defendant aimed the firearm at a person. What's the only thing that's required is that the defendant discharge at a building. I see that I've exhausted my time, so unless Your Honors have any more questions, I will conclude here.
Thank you very much. You were court appointed, and you have the sincere thanks of the court for taking on this case and for so ably representing your client.
It was a pleasure, Your Honor.
Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Your Honor.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.